often speakers are socialized to say, this is my topic. As I'm getting more sophisticated, as I'm getting more experience as a speaker and figuring out like, what is the impact that people have? What is the one takeaway that they have? It has been a challenge for me to be able to move away from topic centric and focus more on what is my message.
Welcome to the podcast that helps speakers and writers like you grow their impact and income. This is Stage, Page, and Screen. I thought you were mad at me.
Well, I wasn't.
Well, let's start there. I apologize.
Okay, good.
I did not do something to upset you. I haven't seen you since Mexico.
I know, man. And that's my fault.
Since I woke you at 3 a.m., you were wearing, as the listeners will remember,
yes,
the flamingo bathrobe.
Right. Well, you had loaned it to me, and I appreciated that because I was so cold.
I was so stunning.
I was
took
so
my
chilly.
Breath away. You opened up the door, and I thought, man, what a sight.
What a sight. I hate giving him bad news and letting him know that all flights everywhere are canceled all the time.
That was a crazy few days.
Man, it was.
And I thought it was just time for me to become a citizen of Mexico.
Yeah. Or at least dual citizenship. I feel like it really served you well, especially when things are getting hard in the economy. You could just flee.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
I believe so.
Yeah. I remember I had to, one of the speakers was talking me through how to get home. Because yes. This was during that Boeing situation where I guess the emergency exit row window popped off or something.
Sure. As they
not
do.
Ideal.
No.
Not ideal. Especially with that platinum status. Is that what you get? You get free drinks and a breeze.
I would not sign up for the card that day. No.
No, not worth it. So one of the speakers was like, oh yeah, you fly to Tijuana and then you just go through this tunnel. And I thought, growing up, my grandma always warned me about these very sort of situations you were describing.
Yes.
This sounds terrifying. And it was not at all. It was so... The Tijuana airport is nicer than like the San Diego airport.
Yeah, Orange, is that right?
Beautiful airport.
Yeah.
Stunning.
Yeah. Yeah.
The next flight home was going to be like a week or something. But if we flew to Tijuana, walked across the border through this mystery, make grandma nervous tunnel, then you get an Uber to San Diego.
I saw this film. It was excellent. Liam Neeson played the lead.
Right. He was there. Was there. Yeah. I felt safe, but also scared. If he's there, I go, somebody's dying.
Yeah. We don't need his special set of skills. Yep.
Yeah, I popped off to him. That's probably a good idea.
I'm just glad you made it back safe. And but I got to be honest, my wife and I were just talking about this because we were able somehow to make it home that day on our original flight, a Boeing aircraft. And
I'm not bitter about that.
No, I know that. I know that. But we were a little bit because when we got home, we rushed home, of course, to be with the kids. They said, oh, you could have stayed longer. My in-laws who were taking care of them, oh, that would have been fine. And so I feel like I missed out on this opportunity to hang out with you guys for another couple of days by ourselves, kid-free, in Mexico.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, the re-entry from Mexico is difficult because for the past 3 days,
yes,
you've had people waiting on you, bringing you margaritas and guacamole on cue.
Yeah.
And then when you go home, you go, well, where is the guy? Where is he? And then you realize,
is he okay?
You're the guy.
Yeah,
for your family, you are that guy. Get your wife a margarita and the guacamole.
That's absolutely correct. Hey, I'm excited to talk to our guest who is also in Mexico with us. I don't know if she got home or not. She might be calling us from Mexico.
I see. What a phenomenal transition.
Did you like that?
That was beautiful.
I had to rewrite that 3 or 4 times.
I feel like you had a margarita before you did that because it reminded me of the smoothness of you two margaritas deep.
That's right. That's right.
Well, let me talk about our guest today.
Please do.
Nikki Joyner. She did indeed join us in Mexico. She's one of our speakers. She helps college students navigate diverse environments with confidence and understanding. She takes a practical approach when discussing these very topics. We're going to probably focus on something I see her kind of navigating right now, which is the challenge of unearthing your message. So we're going to we're going to explore all the different components of that.
That's so
good. Let's get her in the room here.
All right, sounds good. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Do it, Jesse.
I've pressed the button multiple times.
Hit that button. Okay. Move that bus. Move that bus.
Where's Ty when we need him?
I know.
Probably prison.
Come on. Hey,
there
Nikki.
She is.
Hi. How's it going?
Good to see you. Looking like you're ready to host a radio broadcast. This is incredible.
Also helping planes land at the same time.
I feel like I'm ready to take orders at the drive-thru for the next hour.
No, this headset is way too serious for that. This is giving me those Dave Ramsey vibes. I think you're about to tell me that some of my spending is idiotic.
Yeah. I'm all about it. I'm about to tell myself some of my spending is idiotic.
Put your cash in an envelope. That's all I learned.
Yesterday, I was coming in the house and Adam was already there. And I went to our office area and I was getting ready to put on my headset and I couldn't find it. I walked into the bedroom and Adam was using it to play video games.
No, he didn't.
I was like, honey, this is not yours.
No, come on.
But that reveals the quality of the headphones.
This was not covered in the marriage vows.
And your head's a little bit bigger than mine. So we gotta don't use my headset.
It's time for Adam. We're gonna launch a GoFundMe and we're gonna get Adam his own headset. That's what's happening.
Yes, he needs it.
Yeah, put
he
the needs it. Link will be in the show notes. Jesse, thank you.
Totally. Patreon.
Make it happen.
Okay.
All right, Nikki. Here's where I want to start with you. I want to talk through the complexities that you're facing right now in kind of unearthing your message. You know, they talk about the difference between sort of finding your voice. I feel like you have your voice. There's this distinctive way in which you show up, your personality, your tone, the way in which you like to teach. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, I see you right now kind of circling to try to pinpoint what your message is. So what have you learned in that process?
Whew, it has been a whole process. As I think about this, I think often speakers are socialized to say, this is my topic. And as a newer speaker, I have been socialized to tell people what I talk about, not my message, not my through line, right? So as I'm getting more sophisticated, as I'm getting more experience as a speaker and figuring out like, what is the impact that people have? What is the one takeaway that they have? It has been a challenge for me to be able to move away from topic centric and focus more on what is my message and how do I differentiate that message from other speakers. I started out as a speaker talking about really socially complex topics around equity and access and diversity and representation in 2020. And that was a time where I think our world really needed this to be elevated. And that was 7 or 8 years into my own journey doing that work. So I was super uniquely positioned at that time to be able to address some of these topics with audiences who had really similar lived experiences to me. And now I think we're seeing a shift in the world and the ways in which people are approaching these topics. So I always find that like I have this undertone of inclusion about everything that I do and I want to center it, but I don't know if inclusion is my topic. And right now I'm trying to figure that out. So that is a most definitely excellent question. And that's my roundabout answer of saying it's tough. But the biggest thing that I've learned is trying to get away from topics as a speaker and focusing more on like, what's my message?
Your situation is unique, but I imagine there are other speakers that'll be listening to this conversation that are struggling with it as well.
Absolutely.
For me, I feel like when I got started, I was clear on what my message was, and then the tactics of being a good presenter of that message was something I was going to have to painfully, slowly, rep after rep, speech after speech, develop. I feel like your situation is a bit of the inverse. I feel like you have a lot of those speaking skills and instincts there, and now you're trying to identify, you know, sure, there's a lot of messages you could give, but what's like that one message that just encompasses everything about who you are, the challenges you've been through, the successes you've been through, your quirks, your strengths, your weaknesses, your personality, like all bound up in that. And that's a fascinating thing to watch and try to support you through, but it's also like that's a puzzle for you to solve, not for anyone else to. So what would you say to a fellow traveler on that journey who's trying to pinpoint, you know, maybe they've got the speaking chops, but what is that message that I want to deliver?
Oh, yes. I would say first and foremost, we have to dig really deep on our own story. That is a challenge for me. I came to speaking by way of being a trainer, so helping people to upskill themselves, and an educator by nature. I worked in higher education for 10 years, and a lot of people who want to be speakers also work in education. So if that's you and I'm talking to you, hey, hi, hello. But as I think about that, the first piece of advice I have is we have to think really critically about like what is our own story and our unique voice in our story, so that in turn we can shape our message in our own voice through our own story. I have vastly underestimated how often people want to hear my story and the impact that my story has on the audience. I've always just assumed that they wanted information. So I think that's the first thing around anyone that's going through this journey is don't underestimate the power of your story. The second I would say is let's get away from topics. Like speakers just like to be like, I'm a speaker and I talk about X, Y, and Z. And I love that for like car ride conversation, sure. But as we think about like who is the audience, what does the audience want? And more importantly, who's the buyer for that audience? What are they looking for? I think we have to think really critically about like, what's our message? How's it going to impact people? But also, how's it going to get you where you want it to be? If you want to be in big rooms talking in front of hundreds and thousands of people, you're probably not going to be a trainer, Nikki. I'm talking to myself here. So you might not have this 60-slide deck teaching people about implicit bias. That might not be your thing, right? So if that's you and you're a content girly like me and you've got a lot of stuff, thinking about like who's your audience, what do they want to know? And then I think the third thing, which is the biggest thing I have learned from being on the TYS team so far, is what is the one takeaway? What is the one takeaway? I remember, Josh, during our first meeting that we had, you said, Nikki, you've got about a dozen takeaways in this session. Need you to get from a dozen to like one, right? And I still struggle with that. And I think a lot of folks, as they're finding their message and their differentiation around their message, figuring out what's that one takeaway that people can remember you for. And I think for me, that is what I'm still trying to figure out. But my biggest piece of advice would be to focus on that through line, focus on that message in a way that gets the audience from A to B. We don't want to give them 1,000 different things, right? I'm not interested in buffet style. I'm not giving you a CVS long list of things, CVS receipt, right? Long list of things. Instead, I really want to just focus on the one thing. So I think that'd be my last piece of advice is what's the one thing?
Those are great insights. I want to double click on the idea of the story and the takeaway. It seems, I agree, that the personal story is important to weave in. And trying to think deeply about it, I think there's, if you're going to talk about a topic, there's almost sort of a candor in which you need to approach it, that you could only approach it with that certain level of candor if you yourself have gone through it.
Yep.
Otherwise, you're going to kind of tiptoe around the topic in a way that just doesn't kind of strike through the malaise of the audience. And sounds like you're talking about someone else, like a thing that they went through, but they're going to be able to tell in your emotionality and the roller coaster of emotions that it wasn't a thing for you. How do you, so I'm not going to name any specific things, so I'll keep this vague, but I think the lesson will be helpful. So there are some things I know about your personal story that I approach you and I go, ooh, that might be really compelling to an audience. And it seems like with some of that stuff, your current stance is like, I agree, but like not quite yet. Mm. How do you, and again, we don't need to divulge the specifics because I think the lesson is still going to hold. How do you determine, okay, this is something I'm ready to kind of share publicly and weave in to a message versus this is something I might forever keep private, or this is something I need to keep private for a period of time until I sort through it a little more?
Oof, I love this question. I think while well-intended, there are a lot of speakers that use speaking as their own therapy to share their own stories. And I've seen it way too many times in a way that doesn't necessarily impact the audience the way that we want to. So I think for me, I'm hypersensitive around that because I've been in situations where I'm like, is this a session or a therapy session?
Right. We should be invoicing the speaker here.
Right. We're a little flipped here. So yes, I think that's the first thing. But, you know, as I think about it, there's two main indicators for me. First is, and this is kind of weird, so please be mindful around it. But for me, when I get uncomfortable, I get like hot behind my ears. It's just like my tick. So if I am talking about one of my stories and I get hot behind my ears, I'm like, that's my tick. I don't know if I'm like ready to do that. So that would be the first thing. It's just like my own personal tick. If you have your own personal tick around something that you know kind of like sets you off, or you know that you're uncomfortable if you blab, you know that you're uncomfortable if you sweat, if you start to stutter. For me, it's the background, the hot behind the ears. That's when I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to talk about this story publicly. And then the second one is, as I think about the reach of my message, there are a lot of things about my life that people closest to me don't know. So am I comfortable? And I always say my grandma, because she's like the closest person to me, right? But like, am I comfortable if grandma hears this or sees it on a YouTube video? Would I be cool with that? And I think for me, there are some things around my story, my identity, my lived experiences, and even like past experiences that I've had that I don't know that I check both of those boxes. So that's where it gets a little tricky. I think specifically for the first one around like, is this making me uncomfortable to talk about in common language with just friends, family, et cetera? One thing that's really helped me is journaling. I like to journal a lot. I like to voice note a lot because sometimes we experience things, but we don't necessarily know and are able to process those stories. So while I've experienced a lot of things, I don't think I've processed them in a way that allows me to speak about them where there is a message attached to it, right? Telling a story is different than a story with an outcome and an actual message. And I don't know that I'm there yet for some of those things. So for me, that's how I decide. Am I getting hot behind my ears? Is it okay if grandma sees it? And am I ready and comfy to talk about it in front of a large audience?
Yeah, you definitely want it to be something that serves the audience. I heard this phrase once that said, heal the wound and then reveal the scar.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of wisdom, and you got to first kind of privately deal with it, sort through it, because otherwise you won't have any helpful insights.
Right.
It might be a jarring story, an interesting story, a compelling story, a dramatic story, but it's all of that is just a precursor to get to something helpful.
Absolutely.
To someone sitting in the audience. So I certainly resonate with that. There are, you know, things in my own life. It's like, if I was to talk about this in a speech, I would just come off as bitter and frustrated and angry, because I am currently bitter and frustrated and angry about like these category of things in my life.
Yep.
Maybe a couple of years from now, I'll have like a nice, healthy perspective on it, but not for now.
Yes.
So your a component of you I find interesting is, you know, I started as a speaker and then became an agent. You kind of started in this agent world and then became a speaker. What did you learn about that side of the speaking business that has informed your approach to speaking and working with clients?
Oh, this is an excellent question. So I really wanted to be a speaker first. And in 2015, I started asking everyone to pick me up on their roster and nobody would take me. I didn't have enough formal training. I wouldn't pay for their training program. I didn't have an audience. My topic was too divisive. Gosh, the list goes on and on. So then I just became an agent because I was like, well, if nobody will book me, I suppose I'll book myself. And I learned a couple things about that. One, I learned that the speaking business is highly relational. So typically people are not booking speakers that they don't have a relationship with. And those relationships are largely built at events, at conferences, where folks can be present together and that people can get receipts, right? People want receipts, whether it's a demo video, a demo reel, they want to see you live in person, whatever it is. So I think that's the first thing I learned. The second thing that I learned being an agent was around what do we promise and what do we deliver on? So as someone who is newer to booking speakers, I book for myself and then other people on our team also. And I just wanted us to get booked, right? I just want us to be on stage and impact all the lives. And there was a lot of business acumen that I was missing around like how much do we charge for those things? What's the financial investment? What's the package include? And how do we make sure that this is relevant for the audience, the speaker, and the buyer? There was a lot of things trial by error. And I think the biggest thing I learned from that is I don't always have to say yes to everything just because I want me or someone else to have a microphone in their hand. So I would say the business acumen around that, there's a lot of terms that I was not familiar with, like income and revenue and all of these things. I'm just like, that sounds good, I guess. So there was a lot of trial and error around that. But I think the third thing that I probably is most important and what drew me to TYS specifically is like the message that the speaker has is the product. You know, we're not out here selling candles or t-shirts or anything. Like their message is the product. And I learned that it's so, so, so important to continuously invest in that message. You can be an excellent speaker. That doesn't mean that you're going to be booked on stages. You can be excellent at booking and great at sales. That doesn't mean that you're a great speaker. Those are two separate things. Yes. And I learned that while I have some business acumen, I can be pretty savvy. I want to be the person with the microphone to impact people. And that's why I wanted to make the shift. So I started randomly messaging different agencies to be like, hey, what do we think about this? And that's how I found TYS, a random message while I was there sitting at the mall waiting for my mom to try on a dress. I was like, oh, I found this and here we are. A couple months later, we're here.
Amazing. Well, our thanks to your mother.
Yes. Yes.
Indeed. I mean, I certainly agree with this idea that the product is the message. You know, yep. That everything, for a speaker, everything rises or falls based on the quality of that speech, because that's what the client is risking, their reputation, their once a year event.
Absolutely.
All of that, the hassles, the details, the money that go into gathering those folks. I've been thinking about this idea and I'd love to run it by you of like, how do we as speakers gauge if our speech is hitting the mark? And this is, I mean, you know, Nikki, I nerd out about a variety of things, but this one in particular went deep in the weeds on, and I feel, and feel free to disagree, I think there's kind of three unique components, almost like a Venn diagram. That's my tick, is a Venn diagram.
Okay.
If I start thinking in a Venn diagram, I go, ooh, that's a good idea that I want to share. Right? Hot behind the ears, don't share it. A Venn diagram applicable, definitely just spam people with it all the time.
Love it.
All right. So here's what I think the Venn diagram is. And then I'd love you to push back on it and talk about how you relate to it. Three components. Number one, the audience's feedback.
Yep.
So when I started speaking, I spoke to students. Students versus adults have a very kind of feedback if the speech is excellent. And that some of those indicators will be that they will like form a line to talk to you afterwards, want you to sign things and want to take selfies with you.
Absolutely.
You know, when you walk into that assembly, you're sort of like the plague. They're like, this is going to be terrible. I hate this. I can't even believe I'm saying this out loud, but I'd rather be back in class. Why are we in here? And then 60 minutes later, you know, it's clear 60 minutes later, you didn't suddenly become famous, but there's something that compels them to have a moment with you, a signature, some mm-hmm. sort of artifact, not because you're famous, because you're not, but something that you said in your message impacted them. And in kind of that sweet middle school or high school way, securing that artifact is their way of saying, this really touched my life, and I want to have a snapshot of this moment. Mm-hmm. So that's Venn diagram component number one. Would you like me to pause here? Do you want me to lay out the other two?
Oh, I have thoughts about this.
Go.
100%. I think it is a tall tale sign if after your speech, everyone gets up and leaves. I always know that it was not a slam dunk. If nobody yes. comes up to me afterwards, I'm like, no, not a slam dunk. And it's a good sign to be aware of those things, right? And even as someone who talks about like socially complex things, like I talk about racism, I talk about oppression, like I talk about hard topics, when I still have students come up to me afterwards and are like, gosh, I really resonated with what you said. I know that there's a little bit of turning points and the wheels are turning. But yes, I would say 100%. Those like selfie moments, people coming up to talk to you afterwards is a tall tale sign. I would have said that would have been my number one.
Yeah. Now I speak to adults, and adults are different. They will rarely say, sign this, unless there's a book signing.
Yeah.
Rarely the selfie thing. You're more likely to get a standing ovation from an adult audience because they kind of know, like, this yep. is a way in which we can kind of, you know, show appreciation that was better than we expected it to be. I think that's really what it's saying. But like an adult audience, maybe I'm just not doing good, because sometimes an adult audience will give me a standing ovation and then they would just get up and leave. I'm like, okay, a little confused here. Did you love it or did you hate it?
It is so funny that you say that, because the first all adult audience I ever did was with TYS. And at uh-huh. the end, some of the folks started standing up, and then everyone stood up and started clapping. And I was so overwhelmed because I was like, this has never happened to me before. But I totally get it. Adults just show appreciation differently, I think, than students do.
Hi, friends. It's Jesse Rice, co-host and producer of the podcast. Normally, you'd hear from Josh at this point, offering you the opportunity to learn more about how to launch or grow your speaking business or write and publish your book. But since I also edit the podcast, I just cut his part right out. That gives me the opportunity to do the pitching. But from the perspective of someone who is a former student of the program and someone that has benefited tremendously from the wisdom and experience and the countless practical insights that make the stage, page, and screen training program so powerful. Look, Josh isn't paying me to say this. I do it for the community service hours. My point is, and all kidding aside, as one that has truly benefited in massive, life-changing, dream-come-true kind of ways from this content, I can't recommend stage, page, and screen highly enough. And I really mean that. To go and learn more for yourself about making your speaking and writing dreams come true at stagepagescreen.com. That's stagepagescreen.com. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, I think the standing ovation, again, with these things as a speaker, I just find it so tricky. You can't, you know, if you have a couple events where you get a standing ovation, then you don't get one, you can... Yep. Like that component can start to get to you. And it's like, okay, I shouldn't expect that anyway. There's like an ego component there you have to guard against.
Absolutely.
It's like the standing ovation is not the something about you. It's just like you serve them. And as adults, we know like this is the thing we do to show you went above and beyond clearly in your preparation and delivery of that. So So I'm going to briefly stand on my feet for 11 seconds. I'm going to bother myself and my ankles for 11 seconds to show you appreciation.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It is. It's definitely good to know your audience too. So knowing if you're talking to college students and the adults that support them, how they respond to you is going to be different. So you want to make sure that you bucket those things so that you don't go in with like unrealistic expectations around like expecting a standing ovation from a bunch of college students. Like, that's not going to happen.
Now that's interesting because most of my student time was high school students. Would you say a enthusiastic group of college students, if it went well with them, would you have those similar signals, such as they might want to stand around and talk, they might want a selfie, they might want you to sign something? Would those kind of components be similar with a college audience?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's totally going to depend too on the audience. A lot of college audiences are really engaged students versus a lot of your high school, middle school, elementary school students are all there because it's assembly, like they have to be. But a lot of the college audiences, they're coming to these things largely because they want to. So you get a lot of students afterwards that resonate with the message that want to talk. I so much so that I actually started putting in my feedback form, like, do you want to talk? Like, do you want to follow up? Just check this button, because I would get lines of students and it would kind of overwhelm me a little bit. And I know that there's a lot of other college speakers that also experience that because the audience is just slightly different. They're opting in, right? As opposed to being like, this is fifth period and you're going to assembly. Can't wait to listen to the speaker.
Yes. And so their sharing is less of like, if you talk to middle schoolers, if it goes well, they will stand in line. When they get to the front, they'll stare at you, say nothing, expecting you to either have another keynote prepared just for them, a customized joke or roast about them or their appearance, or they'll just like touch your shoulder, say that was great, and then like run away. It sounds like maybe with college students, there would be more of a, hey, you shared this vulnerable thing. Now I want to in turn sort of share how I viewed that vulnerable thing by sharing a bit of my own story. Is that accurate?
Yep. I would say about half the time it's that. The other half the time, instead of the new keynote presentation or the funny joke, it's, I have this problem that I'm experiencing and I was wondering what you think about it based upon whatever your topic is. So a lot of times I get like consulting on the spot with college students.
Yes.
So I think, you know, definitely if you're working with college students, they're a little bit more developed in the brain, right? So as you're talking about things, they're thinking about how does it apply to my own life? So when I'm talking about like building community and finding sense of belonging with people, I will have people come up to me afterwards and share the theses around what's happening in their organization and then ask me, well, what do you think I should do? Because the wheels are starting to turn and they're applying it to their own lives, which I think is the biggest compliment for me, because that's ultimately what we want.
Yes. And you're not going to ask advice from someone that you don't trust. So clearly in your message, you establish yourself as a trustworthy authority.
Yes.
I love it. Okay. So that's component one of the Venn diagram. Component two is the customer feedback. So the person who sign the contract, sign the check, risk their reputation. Of all the speakers they could pick for their annual event, they put their neck on the line, they chose you. And for me, what I'm looking for there is hyperbolic feedback, either in person or on the post-event survey. So I'm not looking for, it was good, it went well. I'm looking for language like, that was the best ever, or one of the best ever, sort of WWE over the top rope, hyperbolic language that communicates, hey, I kind of took a risk and it was even better than we could have hoped for. How does that diagram strike you?
100%. I think as an agent, this was probably one of the biggest things that I learned. You know, we as speakers, we want to impact the people. And in a lot of cases, as students, right? We're working with students and we want to impact them. So we really focus heavily on the students. I found that as an agent, a good growth area for me was like, how am I fluffing the buyer? how am I making sure that like they have a really good, robust experience? Because even if the speech is excellent, but the process, not so much, their overall kind of evaluation is not excellent, even if the speaker was excellent. And that's one of the things I love about TYS so much is we have a process that is like just wildly amazing. And it just makes the buyer feel really secure in their decision. So by the time we get there, it's a slam dunk home run because yeah. we already know that they feel excellent about the process. So I would say 100%, this is an area that I think a lot of new speakers gloss over because they want to get the good feedback from the students, which is awesome. But yes. 8 times out of 10, the student's not the one signing the check.
Correct. Yeah,
so
correct.
We got to make sure that the buyer's happy.
Yeah, looking back on my years speaking to middle school and high school students, there was a period of arrogance and hubris, and which was really just masking fear, where I was so focused in on making the students have a good time, which really meant laughter because that just fed my insecurity because I knew they were with me, that I would not only not consider what was the message goal of the adult that hired me, but just completely ignore it. You know, it's like, well, I know better. I do this all the time. I know how to get them engaged. And I think just little things like that, just not, you're not writing a brand new speech. That's not what they want, but you are like contextualizing your best hits, your tried and true message to, they tend to not have a laundry list of ask, but just a couple things that feel off in our school or with our student body, or man, they really seem to be struggling with this, or there's this air of this happening on our campus that we can't seem to crack through. Like, can you speak to that? And if you do that and that adult can see the students laughing, leaning in, getting quiet at the right moments, I think that 1-2 punch, that's where you get the hyperbolic language of like,
absolutely,
you know, she was able to speak to the students in a way in which, you know, me as the adult who sees them every day can't. And she was also an ambassador of the message. She kind of took the message in there and snuck it in there.
Exactly.
Beautiful. Okay. Third component of the Venn diagram, I'd love to hear your thoughts on. Spinoff. Meaning, from every speech you do, how many speeches do you directly book from that speech? So now I have kind of two ratios in mind that I view as like, this means it's going well. There are closed environment ratios. So this would be a school, a college. It's kind of like everyone in our community is here. You know, a conference, it's like there might be 20 different schools represented there, 50 different schools represented there. If you're speaking at that school or at that college or to that school staff, it's like, well, kind of everybody's here. Everybody's here. But I still think you can have like a 1-3 ratio of spinoff there, meaning if you do such a good job at that high school or such a good job at that college, oftentimes that adult buyer decision maker or other adults in the audience will trip over themselves to reach out to the college 20 miles down the road, the middle school 20 miles down the road where her buddy is the principal there, and say, oh my goodness, we just had this speaker. It was, again, hyperbolic, one of the best we've ever had. And then conferences, I think that should be probably more of like a 1-10 ratio, where for, you know, you do that one college conference keynote, there's probably 40 different colleges represented in the audience, and you should be booking 10 of them. Like, that is a sign that your speech is so good that it fuels your speaking business through that spinoff.
This spinoff ratio concept is, I think, something that a lot of speakers swing and miss on, because we just go based upon how we feel or like one of these other areas. What did the buyer say? What did the students say? Which is great. And it makes us feel good. And to a certain amount, it kind of fuels the ego a little bit to be like, okay, I am doing this right. But let's be honest, we're in this business for two reasons, to impact lives and to get paid, because a lot of us do this as our jobs. So as we think about that, this spinoff ratio is probably the most important to me. I'm so glad that you brought it up. It's something that I learned early on. And as we think about like, what are the really key decisions that we make as speakers in order to make that happen? I remember the very first big keynote session that I did was earlier this year. And Josh helped me out with it. And in my slide deck, I had no sort of call to action about bring this message to your campus, come and make it happen. Josh was like, great, Nikki, content, awesome. We're missing one thing here. How do you feel about this? So this was the first time I had ever pitched myself. And I do the session, I pitch myself. If we can have a vulnerable moment, it was a swing and a miss. And I was so uncomfortable doing it. And then I saw it on video. So I was even more uncomfortable watching myself back through pitching my first time, actually pitching myself. And I think there might have been 400 people in that audience. I did not get a single spinoff gig from that session. And I think that was a realization moment for me to be like, one, Nikki, there was definitely some things that we could have worked on message-wise in order to make it a little bit more clean and crisp and impactful. But two, like Nikki, when it came time to close the deal, I couldn't do it. And I got so uncomfortable. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my gosh, I love sharing my message, but selling myself and selling what I offer is challenging, know that you're not alone in that. And I felt that a lot. So I think the spinoff ratio concept is so important, but it also has to come with the level of confidence that you have in yourself to be able to say, this message can go to you. This message can go to other places outside of just what you rehearse or you practice for your actual speech. So that'd probably be the only thing that I would add for that is a lot of us are really comfortable being on the stage. A lot of us are really uncomfortable sharing the messages that we have. But when it comes time to sell ourselves, sometimes we get less comfortable. And I know that I experienced that a lot, especially around this concept of us like the spinoff ratio, which is why I found the best agency in the world to represent me. So you should also look into that too.
Well, listen, you clearly have no problem pitching us and TIS.
I mean, I don't.
We have to put a sponsored ad on this thing now at this point. Go to the affiliate link, /Nikki for 10% off.
Please.
So watching the video back, was it your keynote you feel like was a swing and a miss, or the pitch towards the end of the keynote?
Ooh, I think it was both. And the reason why the pitch was a swing and the miss, because the keynote was a swing and the miss. Mm-hmm. It was like an inception moment. So I knew that there were specific things in the keynote that I was like, wow, that just did not land the way that I wanted it to, or I envisioned this being different. So when it came time to pitch, I felt a sense of like ineptness in me to be like, okay, Nikki, you're telling people how awesome this was, but you know it wasn't very awesome. So I think, you know, it was definitely a little bit of both. But again, the more practice we get, the better we get. I use the baker's dozen analogy. So shout out to grandma if you're watching this. My grandma always used to make a baker's dozen. So if you're not familiar, it's 13 instead of 12. So she could
Praise
give me
Jesus.
One. Yep.
Praise
and she would give me one. No one would ever know.
Yeah.
So for every 12 gigs I do, I always try to do one for free that's practice so that I can remain crisp and clean and my message is clear. Last year, I did a lot of paid gigs and I wasn't employing that. I wasn't doing free things. I wasn't practicing. I was getting on a plane, going on another plane to another gig, from gig to gig to gig. And I wasn't crisp. And I wasn't investing in myself, so I didn't employ the baker's dozen rule that I now have for helly good reason. So, to directly answer your question, I think it was a little bit of both. It was because the speech wasn't awesome, so the pitch wasn't awesome.
And thinking about that specific speech, do you feel it was not the right message for that room, for that conference? Maybe some of the material was untested. Maybe there were components that were greatest hits, but it was the weaving them together in a set that came off awkward. Looking back, what do you wish you would have done differently?
Ooh, I think it's a little bit of the all the above. If I could choose D, I pick D. I think absolutely some greatest hits in there that I could see resonate well with students. The transition points are equally as important. So I would say that around like kind of meshing it together. And two, probably the biggest thing that I underestimated, being in front of 100 people is different than being in front of 400 people.
Yeah.
The space in the room, the echo in the room, when students are at round tables versus in seats. In this particular case, in the keynote, the students were in round tables. So they're looking at each other, which means it's tricky, right? So I think as a speaker who doesn't have, I mean, I've only been speaking professionally for 4 years now. I never had an experience where I had, you know, 400 or 500 people in a ballroom with round tables and a huge echo. I never had that experience. So when I was up on the stage, I just didn't know how to handle it. And I think a lot of us get into situations where people believe in us and they believe in our message. So they give us these great opportunities. But there were just some things that I was like, I wouldn't have known that until I actually knew it and experienced it myself. So I would say definitely a combination of the both. But if I had to pinpoint one, I vastly underestimated the space I was going to be in and the impact that that setup was going to have. And I wish that I would have been a little bit more forthcoming around what would have worked better for me to deliver the message better to the event planner. But I was just a little scared. And I think that happens.
Roundtables are indeed incredibly tricky.
It was challenging.
Yeah, that is a really tricky scenario. And then if you're someone who is more used to interactive training, workshops, let's roll up our sleeves,
a
keynote, you know, the big room keynote is not that, and that can be tricky.
Absolutely. That was totally me. I remember when we were prepping for the session and I was like, is there anything I shouldn't do? And you were like, don't get off the stage. I know you. I know you're going to want to get off the stage and start talking to everybody. Don't get off the stage because it's only going to matter for like the people in the first two tables. Nobody else is going to be able to see you, Nikki. You're 5 foot nothing. You weigh 120 pounds. Like, you can't get off the stage. And in my mind, I was like, oh, that's how I can engage people. Get off the stage. So, you know, just some of those things that like you don't know until you know. And that's why it's so important to have like a mentor, or it's so important to be with an agency or a group of people that can help you. When you are off in your own land, on your own space, you only know what yourself tells you and you miss a lot of things. And I think for me, before I joined this team, I missed a lot of things because I was only listening to myself.
I know towards the beginning you did an interactive exercise. How did that translate with the bigger group?
Students loved the exercise if they were in the first two rows. They got into it. They loved it. If there was a student from their school, because this was a conference with like probably 50 schools there, if there was a student from their school on the stage, they loved it. Yeah. If they were not in one of those two categories, it was like 9:30 in the morning, I'm snoring. I don't like it. And I think I've been so used to doing that in a different scenario that I was like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. Like, it works so great. But again, we have to know our audience. And that was not the place for that because a majority of the audience members were not, again, in one of those two buckets. So bananas from Walmart, bananas from Kroger is not as easy as it sounds. It's actually a lot different. So I'm learning those things as I go.
Yeah, with a keynote, I found as a speaker, you need it, like it needs to be a benevolent dictatorship.
Absolutely.
You need to kind of have control at all times. Otherwise, it gets tricky. Whereas in small groups workshops, you don't want to be in control all the time. You don't want to be the one talking all the time. You want to make it about them, not them just looking up at the stage. But a keynote isn't that, you know, for good and bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my stance on keynote activities has either been like, if everyone isn't participating, it's probably going to be pretty difficult. You know, like things I've seen work well, I've seen people play Simon Says with the entire audience. They can do it in sort of a fun, hilarious way, but everyone is participating at the same time quickly. that can work well. And then some folks can bring someone up and kind of live interview them in a funny or compelling or authentic way. And that can work. But again, that situation makes me nervous because I go, okay, my speech is locked and loaded and I've put hours of thought into this. And now I'm just going to go pluck a random person from the audience and goodness knows what they're going to say or how interesting or compelling they will be. So that's a tricky component of that interaction.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of speakers come through the education system and realize I could be an excellent speaker. That certainly was my experience. And in the classroom, we are not really a dictatorship, right? We want the students to feel connected to the experience. So we as people, we bring that to every other space. And I think I am learning now that it's okay that that exists in some spaces, but as a speaker, it doesn't exist in all of those spaces. Specifically the keynote space. So as I'm, you know, getting asked to come and keynote at more conferences or keynoting at more events, I'm having to really sit down and think like, one, is this what I want to be doing? And two, if I'm going to say yes to this, they ask for a keynote, Nikki, not a workshop with 500 people. And as the deliverer, we have to know the difference. And I say we, also me. I'm pointing to myself here. Me.
Yeah, I think the best keynotes are, you know, one person shows.
Yep.
It's that. It's insular, it's isolated to the stage. You feel like you're a part of it because you go along on a emotional or intellectual journey, but you're not really a part of it.
Yep.
You're along for the ride. To close the loop on this spinoff thing, I think, you know, when a speaker nails the keynote, The pitch is like all you got to do is just put a hook in the water for those people who are sitting there thinking it already. Meaning, if you have a 60-minute keynote, your pitch is going to come not at minute 59. You're not going to end with a 1-minute commercial or pitch.
Yep.
It's going to come at like minute 54. So from minute 54 to 55, you know, it's just if you've killed it, there are already a dozen people in there thinking, man, they were really good. I wonder if we could get them to. And it's just it's a subtle, hey, if this message would be helpful to you, here's the next step that you can take to bring me to your campus. It's not a hard sell. It's not a, you know, infomercial and, but wait, there's more. It's none of that. And then sort of ending with, you know, a 5-minute beautiful uplift or something empowering or funny or interesting, but not ending on that sales pitch. I think that's how number one, above all, like you got to nail the keynote. And then sometimes people do that, but then they don't just give themselves that 60-second classy pitch. It's not a hard pitch, just a 60-second piece of info for those who are already sitting there thinking it. At that moment, you're not going to be able to convince them otherwise.
Right.
If they're already thinking it, you make it easy. You make them booking you easy and clear. At that 55-minute point, you've either won the room or you haven't. And it just is what it is. And we've all been in situations where we've totally knocked it out of the park. And then others go, yeah, I think I'm just going to skip the pitch because I assure you no one wants my pitch right now because I did not do a good job.
That should have been me. That should have been me.
We've all been there.
But instead, what I did, I'm so glad that you said this. I was trying to convince during that 60 minutes. And I think I'm just now realizing, like, Nikki, what was your end game, right? Like, are you just trying to put the bug in the ear for people that are like, oh, I want to connect the dots here. That could happen. Or are you trying to convince? I was 155% trying to convince because I knew that the speech was not 100%. So I think that's a really good call. I just want to elevate that, that it's not a time to convince. You've already convinced for the last 40 or 54 minutes. It's just time to connect the dots and make it easy.
That's a fantastic distinction. The speech does the convincing.
Yep.
You cannot. I mean, just like we've all read books or watched movies and the second we put it down or walk out of the theater, you text five of your buddies and say, you have to go see this, or you have to read this book, or I just sent you this book, it changed my life. There's no compelling pitch the author could make towards the end of the book, or the movie could make towards the end of the movie that solves that problem. It's like the book, the movie, or the speech does the convincing, and then that leads to that spinoff where everyone who walks out of that room, you know, joins your newsletter, wants to follow along for more, and those that have the authority say, we've got to do everything we can to get her to our campus.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I think, particularly in the keynote space, for all of us, finding that message that can be our message that we can nail to that level, that's why it's good for everyone. It serves the audience. It impacts lives. It honors the decision maker that risks their reputation. And it builds your business because you're going to inevitably get that spinoff.
Yes, 100%. I am all for the Venn diagram. I co-sign on the Venn diagram. Beautiful. And I think that as long as you have two of those things, you're most definitely in a good place. But when you get all three, it's like slam dunk, home run, everybody feels great.
Well said. Well, Nikki, thank you for your time today and sharing. It'll be fun to look back on this conversation. You know, as you're in the process right now of unearthing your message, I have 0.00 doubt in my mind that you're going to find that message that you can absolutely own and rock. And I'm sure right now it's not much fun trying to unearth that, but looking back, this will be a fun artifact for us to have as you were in process.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. And thank you so much for having me today. And thanks for believing in me. I think, you know, as people who want to share our message, we just really need one person to believe in us and to help us, make us feel like we can reach the stars. And that's really where my head's been at the past couple of months. So thank you for being that person for me. And I hope if you're listening to this, you find your person if you have not already.
Well, my pleasure. Easy to believe in. Thanks again, Nikki.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.